This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Happy Thanksgiving. Hope you're enjoying your holiday. Maybe you're out and about traveling. If so, you might choose to use some of that extra time on the road to check out a compelling new podcast we helped to introduce about a month and a half ago. Our friends down the hall at Side Effects Public Media have produced a new series called Sick. Generally, it's about the things that go wrong in the places meant to keep us healthy. Specifically, this season revolves around a now infamous fertility doctor in Indianapolis who used his own sperm to impregnate his patients without their knowledge. We originally aired this episode the day the podcast debuted. Since then, hosts Jake and Lauren have been featured on WAMU's national talk show 1A, and Sick made Vulture's list of the best new true crime podcasts. Again, happy Thanksgiving. We hope you enjoy today's show, and you can find Sick wherever you get your podcasts. Joining us in the studio today are Side Effects Public Media reporters and hosts of the new podcast, Lauren Bavis and Jake Harper. Lauren and Jake, great to have you today.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having us.
So the two of you have been hard at work at making the debut season of Sick, which launched today. Congratulations to you both, by the way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Really quick, before we get into it, if someone's listening and they want to check out or bookmark the series to listen to later, Jake, where can they find it?
So the easiest place to go is sickpodcast.org. It's sort of our one-stop shop. So there's a link there that you'll see to subscribe, and you can find your app and click on it and hopefully get to the right place. And if you can't, just let us know. I guess if you've never listened to a podcast before, we also have a page that is sort of a how-to guide for that as well. So if you don't know what a podcast is, but you're interested, feel free to click on that and you should be able to get what you need.
Can you first introduce us to the concept of Sick?
Sure. With any podcast, you're basically asking people to subscribe to something and listen to it in their spare time. Mm. So it's a little bit different than what we normally do here at our radio station. We want people to tune in week after week. And so with Sick, with health reporting in general, we had this problem, which is that health policy stories can be kind of dry if you don't have the right elements. And so we wanted to create something that was a little bit more exciting and actually drew people in and made them want to listen. And so we decided to borrow some major components from serial true crime shows. So we're telling a story with heroes and villains and suspense. And sort of along the way, we're going to educate people about the healthcare system.
And the first episode of season one dropped this morning. What are we exploring this season?
So this season is all about fertility treatment and fertility medicine. And we're telling that through the story of a now infamous Indiana doctor named Dr. Donald Klein. And you might have heard about him in news stories because it came to light through a group of half-siblings that he used his own sperm to inseminate his patients when he was a fertility doctor in the 70s and 80s.
Wow. What do people think of today when they think of fertility treatment? What are the standard options available today?
Yeah, so you might think of something that's way more high-tech than used to be available back in the time that we're telling this story. So most people think of IVF, which is in vitro fertilization. And so that is outside the body fertilization. Doctors will give a woman drugs that help her produce more eggs than she typically does in a month. They'll go in and retrieve those eggs, and then they'll also retrieve a sperm sample if that's from her husband or partner or for a donor. They combine those two in a lab, and hopefully it turns into an embryo. And that embryo they put back into the woman's uterus, and then hopefully it becomes a baby. So that's what we're talking about in this season.
So how long have these modern options been available?
So the first IVF successful baby was in England, actually, in 1977. They called Louise Brown the first test tube baby. And then it came over to the U.S. in 1981 was the first successful IVF pregnancy.
In this first episode out now, you talk a bit about how, quote, people have been trying to make babies without sex, end quote, for a long time. Can you tell us about what this history looks like?
Yeah, fertility treatment history is kind of crazy in a lot of ways. There's some sort of silly stories about way, way, way in the back first times of fertility treatment. In the 14th century, we learned about a doctor who said, I think, sperm is the thing that makes a person. So why don't I just put some sperm into a jar and then it'll grow into a human? That's how that works. And obviously that was wrong. We've learned a lot about it since then. But even, you know, continuing going into the past, and we actually had some help from our friends at the Indiana Medical History Museum in looking at some of this history. Fertility issues were always thought to be, you know, the fault of a woman. If it was an idea that she wasn't religious enough, it was a punishment. Something that was funny we learned was George Washington and Martha Washington apparently never had children together. And George Washington blamed Martha, even though she had been married before and had four children successfully with her former husband. So now we can actually look and see, when it comes to fertility treatment, who is the factor that needs to be addressed, if that's a woman and the quality of her eggs versus, you know, a man and quality of sperm, or if it's both and there's a factor that has to, you know, be worked on together.
And even when the science became more sophisticated, did any barriers still exist for people seeking fertility treatment?
Yeah, I think one of the main ones was stigma. I mean, a lot of people, you know, decades ago were, when they struggled with infertility, they weren't necessarily, you know, chomping at the bit to tell everyone about it. It was sort of a secret that they, I mean, Liz White in our first episode, she explains that she didn't talk to her family and friends about it. And part of her experience was not even really communicating with her husband about it all that often. He knew she was going to these appointments, but she really kind of kept him in the dark because that's what she thought he wanted. And that's a problem that continues somewhat today. I think it kind of depends on who you are as a person, whether you feel that way. But, you know, it is a struggle for people, and they don't necessarily want to tell people about it. It's also expensive. A lot of places, a lot of insurance companies don't cover it. In Indiana, insurance companies aren't required to by law. And that means a lot of the expenses can be left up to the patient. Even if you have insurance, some of these medications aren't necessarily going to be covered, or the procedures, or it's really complicated, and a lot of people end up paying a lot of money out of pocket. And then one thing too is just that we sort of read about it along the way is racial inequities can kind of get in the way. If you're an African American person looking to start a family, you don't have as much selection when it comes to finding donor sperm. That's kind of an issue that's been reported on pretty widely.
And the fertility process is, on one hand, a pretty scientific one, yet for families trying to have children, it's often a very emotional matter as well. What did you learn about the emotional aspects of this process?
Yeah, so we can hear actually from Liz White. She's one of the women who you're going to hear from in the first episode.
He sat on one side of his desk, and we're sitting on the opposite side of that desk. I remember tearing up talking about our trial of trying to be pregnant. And I remember just trying to keep my tears, holding back on my tears of the sadness I felt.
So that's Liz White. Yeah, we hear from her in the first episode, and she was going through fertility treatment in the late 70s and early 80s. And yeah, you can hear it's really emotional. She didn't talk to her family about it. She didn't talk to her husband about what she was going through, and she didn't talk to her friends. She told us she even found out later at the same time she had a friend who was going through fertility treatment, and they never even talked about it.
The series follows a doctor who provided fertility treatment in the 70s and 80s. And if we rewind to that time, how was treatment then different from today?
So there was just a lot less patient choice involved. Now, if you're a patient who's looking for a sperm donor, you can basically pick it out of an online catalog. Back then, if you wanted sperm from a donor, that was all in your doctor's hands. The doctor would say it was pretty well practiced around the country. Oh, I'm going to find a medical resident who can be the donor. Either I'm working at a hospital already, or I'm at a clinic that's near a hospital. We'll take a look at your husband, see, you know, what his physical traits are, and I'll go find a student who can, you know, be paid $50 and provide a sample. And back then, they were using fresh sperm that had a higher success rate than frozen sperm. So it also had to happen pretty quickly. It would be, you know, let me run across the street real quick to the hospital, get a sperm sample, drive back, and within an hour actually inseminate the woman.
So back then, you couldn't really choose your sperm donor. Why is that selection piece important to people? I think the answer is probably pretty obvious.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, people like Matt and Liz were looking for someone. They, you know, Matt was looking to find a donor that looked like him. Liz was looking for a donor that looked like her husband. And I think part of it, you know, in the era that Liz was getting this, it had to do a lot with the fact that they weren't A lot of people didn't tell their kids that they were donor conceived. And so, you know, you obviously want that kid to look close to the father, or else, you know, people might start to ask questions. And I think, you know, it's kind of similar today. It's like people want their kid to look like them, even if they are planning on telling them that they are donor conceived at some point. It's just sort of this innate desire, seemingly. You know, Matt White told us that he went after a donor that looked like him, and that was just an important thing to him. He wanted his kids to be as close physically to him as possible. He sifted through the options and eventually settled on a tall guy who happened to like motorcycles, which worried Matt at first.
You know, at that point, obviously I was still super devastated, and I was like, I want this kid to be as close as possible to me. And so, like, you know, if they're just like a, you know, stereotypical like Harley Davidson bike rider, I'm just like,
Yeah. Or it could have been like a crotch rocket kind of motorcycle. Right. That's like a totally different
guy. That's a totally different guy.
And beyond physical traits, people can pick and choose between personal attributes, maybe right down to the zodiac sign in some cases, if that's what you care about.
Right. If you go to a sperm bank website, you can choose things like the donor's hobby, if they can play a musical instrument, what their favorite food is. I was looking at a site today where you can click what celebrity they might look like. If you pay extra, sometimes you can hear an entire interview between the person who's helping to recruit sperm donors and the donor themselves. We actually have a clip from that. You can even hear a clip of them talking about their hobbies, like aquatic gardening.
With aquatic gardening, it's everything's done in water, and you sort of use rocks and different plant species to make like bushes.
So I'd never heard of aquatic gardening before, but if you want a child who's proficient in that, maybe that's the sperm donor you would pick.
We're talking with Lauren Bavis and Jake Harper, the producers and hosts of the new podcast, Sick. Up next, we'll talk about the fertility doctor at the center of the podcast, and we'll go behind the scenes to learn how Jake and Lauren made this podcast a reality. And hi again, it's Matt. Today's show is an encore of a show we aired on October 15th, the day the Sick podcast debuted. Since then, they've released 7 episodes. The final episode of this season will be released next Tuesday. You can find Sick wherever you get podcasts. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Happy Thanksgiving. Before we get back to our encore show we did to mark the debut of the new Side Effects Public Media podcast, Sick, I want to tell you about a little Thanksgiving cheer we spread yesterday. Some fun facts about the turkey industry in Indiana, a little history on some of the best pie available in the state, and some tips on small talk if you're on your way to see relatives you haven't been with in a while. You can find that and all other previous shows wherever you get podcasts. And while we're on the subject, we originally aired today's show the day the Sick podcast debuted. Since then, 7 episodes have been released. The 8th and final one comes out next Tuesday, if you want to catch up. The podcast is about what goes wrong in the places meant to keep us healthy. This season, the series dives into a story centered around fertility treatments and about one particular doctor who impacted generations at his practice, but not in the way that patients anticipated. And we're back now with the hosts of the podcast, Sick, Lauren Bavis and Jake Harper. Now, a central character to the podcast is Dr. Donald Klein. For those of us who are unfamiliar with the name, who is Dr. Klein?
So Donald Klein was a fertility doctor who was in practice from 1971 to 2009. He went to med school in the 60s and spent a couple years in the Air Force. And he really started a practice in 1971. And he joined a private OBGYN practice then. And he sort of took an interest in fertility medicine. And he practiced until 2009. And in the 70s and 80s, he just had a reputation of being the guy to go see. So he was one of the first people in the area to specialize in infertility. Before that, it had kind of been sort of a subset or a, sort of like a side hustle to regular OBGYN work. And so he started, you know, he practiced a little bit, and then he broke out and started his own fertility practice in the late 70s. And then he retired in 2009. And then in 2016, thanks to genetic testing and the persistence of some people who had an interest in this, he was found out to have used his own sperm to impregnate many of his patients.
But at the time,
Did people trust him? Did people seek him out for fertility help? Was he successful?
Oh, yeah. He had a huge reputation of being the best of the best. And he talked about the fact that he had patients from other states outside of Indiana come and see him. And we talked to his former patients who would say that they drove, you know, upwards of an hour to come and see him. He was the guy. And people back then, if they wanted to have a family and they needed help, you wanted to see someone who had a good success rate. And one of the ways to see that is to see how many babies someone produced. And we have Liz White talking about, you know, one of the first times she went to Dr. Klein's office and what she saw.
I remember the wall of pictures of the babies that he had produced.
Did that make you think, like, wow, this guy knows what he's doing?
Yeah. And I was cautiously hopeful. So knowing that I've had 2.5 years of trying, this is just, you know, that's where I was. I had hope.
But he wasn't doing what he said he was.
No.
And I would add, too, that I think just generally people have this trust in doctors. You know, I mean, you don't walk into any doctor's office and expect the person to be lying to you. They have, you know, ethical checks in place. There's a board that makes sure doctors are supposed to do what they're supposed to do. And, you know, I think generally there's a high level of trust that our society places in doctors that it makes it all that more shocking when you find out about these kinds of things.
And as you say, in 2016, the news broke that Klein had been impregnating clients with his own sperm. And that news has existed now for years since then. But there are major questions around the story that still exist.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's why we still decided to do a podcast around it. There's, you know, every few months it seems like there's a magazine piece or a New York Times piece that's either about Dr. Klein specifically or about this issue of doctors deceiving their patients. And we felt like it deserved a deeper look.
And for starters, I think when people hear about a story like this, they immediately think of the women who were the patients and, of course, the children. Do we hear from them in the podcast?
Yeah. So you'll hear from Dr. Klein's biological children, who we generally refer to as the siblings. You'll hear from former patients, their husbands, and you'll also hear from people who worked in the OBGYN field or the fertility field, who were working or trained in the same era as Klein was.
What was your experience then talking with these families? It's such a personal topic. Was anyone hesitant to speak with you?
Yeah, I think, you know, especially the story has been out a while. A lot of the siblings have sort of, some of them have just decided from the very beginning even that they don't want to talk to the media. They don't want their name associated with this. And honestly, we don't know who those people are for the most part. So they don't want to be out there in the media. Then, and some others who maybe were interested in sort of putting their name out there early on have, you know, with the years that this story has been out there, they've changed their minds and they don't want to do it anymore, which is totally fair. I think a lot of people, you know, one of the siblings mentioned that reporters have showed up to her front door and knocked on it and tried to get interviews with her without even, you know, calling first or emailing her first. Wow. Or they call her work to try to get in touch with her, which she doesn't like, obviously. And so I think some people have sort of shied away from the media coverage in the years that the story has been out. And so that made it a challenge, too. But I think eventually we were able to talked to a few people, and that kind of grew to a few more people. And eventually we had enough material that we felt like we could use to talk about some of the sort of the sticky points and topics that we wanted to cover with the story. And so we ended up getting enough.
And genetic testing kind of outed him and sort of got this ball rolling. Were there any other ways that people have found out who their biological father was where this is concerned?
I think, I mean, that's the main one. I mean, technology, I think when this was going on, no one anticipated that you could spit into a vial and mail it to a company and figure out that you're related to this many people. I think no one anticipated that technology, but that seems to be the main way that these stories are coming out now.
So about how many children share Dr. Klein's DNA?
listen to the first episode.
it's a fairly decent number, I would imagine.
Yes, yes, it is. Yeah.
Now, what about the consequences? Does this season have a conversation about accountability in cases like this?
It does, and it's interesting because there have been a lot of cases like this, surprisingly, that we're also going to kind of get into the history of how other people have looked toward justice in this case.
And another question I think a lot of people still have is, who does this? What kind of person does this? Do we gain insight into who Dr. Klein is?
Yeah, we did a lot of research to try to find that out. He's been pretty media shy. I can only think of maybe one or two instances where he's even, you know, entertained reporter questions. So we wanted to find out who was this doctor apart from this, you know, one thing that he did in a very long career. But as for other people who do this, what Klein did isn't an isolated incident. We did a lot of research about a case from the early 90s in Virginia, another doctor named Cecil Jacobson, who was pretty famous for doing two different kinds of fertility fraud or fertility deception. One, he would trick women into thinking they were pregnant by giving them hormone shots and then lying to them about the actual progress of pregnancies that didn't happen. And then he also used his own sperm to father upwards of 75 children. And this was found out before DNA testing, obviously. And he ended up going to jail for that for 5 years. And apart from that, there have been, through these 23andMe tests mostly, cases out of Texas and Idaho, Vermont, Connecticut, and Oregon where doctors are being accused of this. It's not, you know, just an Indiana abnormality.
Do we hear from Dr. Klein himself in this season?
Listen and find out.
So let's pivot over to talking about how you made this story come to life. Why a podcast? What interested you both in this the podcast format specifically, in a way to tell this story?
So we had dabbled in podcasting before, I guess, and we, you know, as part of that experience, we applied for this sort of training program, incubator program through PRX, and got in. And then we sort of, in a way, when we started that program, we sort of started from scratch. Even though we had done some podcasting before, we wanted to sort of revisit our concept and look at it in a fresh way. And so that's how we sort of ended up steering into this true crime territory and in an effort to sort of bring more attention to health policy stories.
What about narrowing down your topic options? Like, how do you develop a sense of what kinds of stories are rich enough to unravel in a series of episodes? I think this one certainly was, but did you entertain others before you landed on this one?
We did, sort of. This one was like a very obvious choice from the very beginning. I'd heard about it. Actually, I heard about it at the Indy 500, oddly enough, because I don't watch TV news, which is primarily where it was reported in the early days. I ran into this medical malpractice attorney who told me about it, and I couldn't – not that I thought about it constantly, but for a long time, I was sort of picturing this case and imagining, you know, what is this like for the children, and, like, how did this guy get caught, and, like, all these questions that we eventually ended up wanting to explore in the podcast. It was more like this story was in the back of my mind as something we could do, and then we had a concept that actually allowed us to explore it. But we have a lot of sticky notes up on an office wall somewhere of, like, story ideas and just things that we'd reported before, but this was sort of an obvious choice from the beginning.
Yeah, your office is a sort of post-it note jungle.
Right.
So yeah. once you landed on this story around fertility, where do you even begin? How do you organize a story like this?
Very carefully. So yeah, it's a lot of file management, a lot of naming things in certain ways so we can find them easier, a lot of timelines and organizing things by dates, especially with the story that jumps around a lot from, you know, the 60s and 70s to the mid-2000s to today. It's, yeah, really changed a lot.
So what kept you anchored? Did the series have sort of a central goal or a mission, or was it a little more dynamic than that?
I think from the beginning we knew we wanted to uncover new things. That's sort of always our goal as reporters, I guess. But because the story had been out for a few years, it kind of seemed necessary to really like go deeper than, at least in some areas, than maybe some other outlets had done. I think with that in mind, we kind of just kept plugging away at it until we set a reporting deadline for ourselves so that we didn't go too crazy into the research and sort of trying to find people. But
yeah, I think the radio stories that you're going to hear on your typical station are about 4 minutes long, and mm-hmm. the quotes that you hear from people are pretty short and concise, something like 10 seconds. And I think one of the ways we could tell this would make a good podcast is because of just how long we could listen to the people who were telling their stories. Instead of a quick soundbite, we got to go in depth and hear from people who were really affected by Klein and who knew them, and letting them tell their story in their own words about what happened to them so many years ago and how it's affecting them today.
And we talked about the voices that we hear from in the series a little bit earlier, but can you talk about the process of just getting in touch with these people? Are you talked about someone, about other reporters knocking on doors, without a phone call or an email ahead of time. Did you get their names from previous reporting? How did you tackle that?
It kind of started, I got in touch with an attorney who knew a member of she knew one of the siblings, I guess is the best way to put it. And so it started with that. And then it kind of, this group of siblings that has grown over the years, they have ways of communicating with each other, and they sort of passed our contact information around. In some cases, they were getting in touch with us. In other cases, we were going back to people we had already talked to and said, like, hey, we'd really like to talk to this specific person. Like, are they willing? Can you put us in touch? It was a lot of that stuff. And just persistence. I mean, some people, like I said, had shied away from the media or in some cases have still continued to stick by that decision. In some cases, we were able to sort of talk to someone, get a no, and then come back several weeks later, and it was a yes, and that turned out to be a great thing for us. But it was a lot of persistence and patience.
You've spent so much time with this story, and is there anything that's stayed with you in particular?
I think something I keep coming back to is this idea of identity and knowing who your parents are and knowing where you come from and how that kind of builds you as a person. I mean, I know personally, growing up, you hear things like, oh, well, you have your mother's eyes or your dad's sense of humor. And just thinking about, what would happen if one day out of the blue, half of that was ripped away from you, and how that would make you reconsider who you are and what your whole life has looked like. And the podcast brings up a lot of questions of nature versus nurture, I think, that have really kind of that have stuck with me.
That was going to be my next question, nature versus nurture. I mean, does some of these people sort of reckon with that of, you have your dad's sense of humor, but you don't share any DNA with him. did anyone kind of explore that?
Yeah, they did. And it's different stories of, some of the siblings knew, they grew up knowing that they were donor children. Some didn't. And so I think that the news hit them in different ways.
And so we found out about this guy in 2016. How long have you been working on this series?
Close to a year at this point. I think Jake did some of his first interviews in December.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I think, part of that time was eaten up by this training program and stuff that we were in. I wouldn't say it was 10 months of solid reporting and writing and stuff. But
you did some training on how to better sort of craft a narrative in the podcast format.
How to do a podcast, not just the narrative side of it, but the management side of it, the technical side of it. That was sort of what we were getting training in. So a lot of our energy was going into that early on. But yeah, I mean, the first interview, I think, just because it's labeled so clearly in our files, I believe it was on the 21st of December of last year, and then it sort of picked up from there.
We got about a minute left. What do you hope that listeners take away from this season of Sick?
So when it comes to health and health stories, I think the best thing anyone can take away from it is that they need to be an informed consumer. You know, as we've been reporting, what I've learned is that 1 in 8 couples goes through fertility treatment. So it's not an uncommon thing, and couples are spending thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars, depending, you know, like what Jake said, if there's any coverage from insurance or not, to start their families. So if you're going to enter this, you need to do it with your eyes wide open, be aware of all your options, and be willing to ask questions and be an informed consumer.
And real quick, what can we expect from maybe the next season of Sick?
Oh, God.
or future episodes.
We will have a new season that'll come out, and we're going to hopefully explore a different story.
Well, our thanks to the hosts of Sick, Lauren Bavis and Jake Harper. Jake and Lauren, thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
Yeah, thanks.
Up next, we'll hear about a new book on how to raise a reader. Author of the New York Times Book Review, Pamela Paul, joins us with tips on getting your kids reading, whether you're starting early with infants or, of course, it's never too late to get your teenager turning pages. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. As a parent of 2 very young kids, I think about this a lot. How do I raise a reader? My 2-year-old and I read at least 3 books a night, usually more. Lucky for us, he's still at a fairly malleable age and we have some time. But what can parents of older children, even teenagers, do to get their kids to read more? That question is the subject of a new book, How to Raise a Reader. And one of the authors joins us on the line now. Pamela Paul is the editor of the New York Times Book Review. Pamela, welcome to All In.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is a conversation for parents and caregivers to kids of all ages. So hang around. We'll go all the way from babies to teens in the next 15 minutes. First of all, I can remember when my oldest was a baby. I was a nervous wreck. First kid, no idea what I was doing. And one thing that I did was just read whatever I was reading at the time out loud to him just to have something to do. Is there such a thing as too early?
Oh my God, you are so on the right track. No, there's no such thing as too early. And, you know, my husband did the same thing with our first when she was a baby. She's now 14. I have 3 kids. He was reading Alice in Wonderland to her too. And I'm like, you know what? She's not understanding this, but that doesn't matter because she is hearing the language. She is feeling the proximity of, you know, her dad. Usually, you know, you have the baby in your arms, you're reading the book. There's that emotional connection. She's hearing the enthusiasm in your voice, and you're creating a habit. And also, you know, it's funny. It can feel really awkward reading aloud to the baby because you're like, this baby is not understanding a single word. But you have to remember, it is a full emotional, full body experience for babies. Every sense is employed, from touch to smell to feel to sound. And it gets the parent into a good habit as well of reading aloud. And sometimes, you know, as a parent, you're like, okay, what do I do with this baby, you know, when they're really small, other than change their diaper and sort of, you know, banter at them. So reading out loud, even if you're just reading the newspaper, that's something to do, and your baby is benefiting from it. They're benefiting from hearing that vocabulary. They're benefiting from that proximity, from the emotion, all of it.
So when your child then starts to understand language, they start to understand what's going on, what's the best course of action? Do you push the age-appropriate envelope? Like, we have a shelf full of children's books ranging from really little kid books like 6 to 12 months all the way up to Golden Books and Dr. Seuss for older toddlers and elementary age. And my kid still picks from that entire spectrum. Do we jettison the baby books for a 2-year-old?
No. Never. No. Because older kids, like, first of all, it's really funny. And if you have multiple kids, you'll find this. You'll be reading a book to the youngest, and the older kids will kind of creep into the room sometimes and curl up, and they want to hear that book because they remember that story, right? And it's nostalgic for them. And the other thing is, picture books do a kind of magical thing. Let's say that child is 5 or 6. They are probably learning to read like 3-letter words, but there are much more sophisticated words in that picture book. So it's operating at a higher level, and you also have the illustration in there. There's a story being told through the pictures that you probably aren't noticing as the parent because you're so focused on the text, but your child is reading those pictures. And older kids like to read those pictures. And pictures, as we know, we live in a very visual culture. They're for every age. grown-ups read coffee table books. Like, we all look at pictures of art. We all go online and look at Instagram, which is all images. People like pictures. So that works for every age. It's really important to remember that when you have a child, you're using books on multiple levels, often for, let's say your child is six, right? There are the books that he can start reading to himself. Then there are picture books that you are reading to him. And then there might be older books that don't have pictures that you can read aloud to your child. Like, you can have a 6 or 7 or 8 year old where you're reading the Chronicles of Narnia aloud to them at night, or you're reading, you know, Little House on the Prairie or Betsy Casey or whatever, you know, classic from your childhood, or maybe even something more modern. But you can read something that they're not ready to read themselves, but they're very happy to listen to you. So there's all different ways and levels in which storytelling operates for the child, you know, for a single age of a child.
That was going to be my next question. I have this dream, you know, I have a practically newborn at home, and I have a 2-year-old, and I'm looking forward to the time when I can read, you know, sort of a non-picture book, a traditional novel, like the Chronicles of Narnia or something like that. What do you think is the best age to start doing that? Or do you just kind of, I'm sure it's different from child to child.
It's different from child to child. It definitely is. And there are some kids that just, one thing is, if your child can't sit still, you know, to like sit through a long picture book, that child can do whatever he wants. He can like roll around on the floor while you're reading aloud a book with no pictures, because they don't have to be sitting there, you know, peering over your shoulder during that. So that actually can work kind of well. I think that there's no point where it's too early. You just have to gauge your child's interest and the way in which, you know, how much is your child really getting out of it? And that comes to an important point, which is that this isn't just about the parent at a certain point. There's a time where you go from, you know, reading the newspaper or your own book aloud to your child, where you really have to let the child take the lead. So it's about letting the child turn the pages when he wants to turn the pages. It's about when your child closes the book and you know, you're done with it, and the child says again, even if inwardly you're like, oh no, you know, that you maintain that enthusiasm and you say, okay, we'll read it again. A lot of people are like, really? Why must I reread the same book, you know, 10 times in a row? But rereading for kids, both when you're reading aloud to them and then when they're reading on their own, studies have shown that that's actually very beneficial, not only in terms of them learning how to read, because eventually they memorize it and then they think they're, you know, quote unquote, reading it, which is a step to reading, but also because characters become friends. It becomes a familiar setting. It becomes a ritual. It becomes comforting. And kids get a lot out of that. And if your job as a parent is to make reading pleasurable, then why wouldn't you give that to your kids? Like, you want to follow their lead.
That's really encouraging to say that you can just read and they can be rolling around in the room as long as they're hearing it, maybe not listening to all of it. That's encouraging. So I know that some parents struggle to read out loud. You know, it's a skill. It's a real challenge for some of us. What are some tips to make that a better experience?
Yeah, you know, it can feel like embarrassing. People can feel self-conscious. And if English isn't your first language, you feel doubly self-conscious, right? But I think, again, that's why it's beneficial to parents to start early. It helps you get comfortable with it. One thing is, you can get too comfortable with it. Like, a lot of parents can get carried away. I sometimes will turn certain books into a song. I would do that often with Mother Goose, you know, when my kids are really little, or with nursery rhymes, or I come up with voices. And my kids would sometimes say to me, you know what, Mommy, can you just read it, not sing it? And it's like, oh, you know, and it's a little hurtful. You're like, but I really like that song that I made up. But you have to remember, it's not for you entirely. It really is for your kid. If they don't like that funny ogre voice that you're using, or if they like don't want you to, you know, read it in this particular way, or if they're like, can we skip over the scary part and just go to the end? Let them lead that, because again, this is for them. You know, it's not for you, even though it becomes really pleasurable, I think, after a while, once you are comfortable with it.
As kids get older, they discover TV and screens. Watching YouTube is fun, but some parents fall into a screen trap and they feel like they can't get out of it. How can parents get out of that and make books more of a priority?
It's hard for parents and it's hard for kids, you know, and I'm not going to sugarcoat that, you know, because this is the easy, quick thing to do. Like, you're stuck in a line, right, at the supermarket, and, like, you could just hand your kid the phone, and then the kid stops whining and squirming around. So one thing I would say, always carry a book. I never left my house without a bunch of books stuffed into my bag. And you could take books that you know that the kid has read 50 times, and even if he is not reading, he knows that story so well that if you hand him that book, he can, you know, quote-unquote, read it to himself while you're waiting online. And it then brings them into the habit of, hey, guys, we're going to run out. We're going to be in the car for an hour. Everybody pack a book so that everyone is doing it. You turn it into something that becomes habitual. So you can do things from a really early age. And then when kids are older, wow, it does get harder. Part of it is modeling. So it's not helpful if you're sitting there scrolling on your phone and you're like, guys, put down the iPad. You know, it's time to read. You're sending kind of a mixed message. So every parent has to come up, every family with their own set of rules. And I think people are looking at ways to try to limit their kids' screen time, not just for reading, but for lots of reasons. So this is, it's a good thing to sort of take stock and say, like, okay, how are we going to squeeze in between all my kids' extracurricular activities, the screen times, the fact that I'm exhausted at the end of the day, whether it's because you've been home with three young children all day or you've been in an office, like, how are you going to set clear guidelines? Because devices are a habit, so is reading. So if you set guidelines and you say, you know what, as a family, 8 o'clock, devices away. We're going to all plug them into the same area, you know, in the family room, and we're not going to touch them. And then we're all going to go upstairs. We're going to go to your bedrooms. We're going to read together. Then you're creating something that becomes, that's what your family does. You can also just build habits around, you know, exposing your kids to books so that there are always books around them. Keep your house full of books. Even if you're not buying all of them, go to the library every week. So every week, if you're going to the farmer's market, if you're going to the supermarket or whatever errands you run, you stop at the library. That becomes something you do. Everyone collect the books you're done with. We'll return them. Let's donate whatever books that we own that we're done with to the library, and we'll pick out some new ones.
But sometimes you want to go and pick out a book for your kid, and it's hard to know what your kids are going to like. I remember walking around the children's book section recently and just being overwhelmed. And in the end, I just grabbed a couple Dr. Seuss books we didn't already have, and I called it a day. What should parents think about when choosing books for their kids?
Well, that's one of the reasons why we have so many recommendations in the book, not just by age, but also by the child's interest, the child's need. That's because, from personal experience raising three kids, and my co-author has three kids, and also from hearing from so many parents when they know that, you know, we work at the book review and children's books, they ask us these questions. Parents are looking for very specific things often for their kids. They're like, my child is really scared about the first day because she's really shy. Or my child is afraid because last year she was bullied in third grade and she's super scared to start fourth grade, whatever it might be. So you're looking for books that sort of have a specific kind of message or story or theme, or you might know, like, my kid really doesn't like sad stories. So I would say, number one, you know your child. Keep what their interests are in mind, but also be open to other things. Sometimes your child is still young. He doesn't know what he's necessarily interested in. There's a reason why the classics continue to sell really well, like Dr. Seuss, as you mentioned. Those books are great, but they're also the books that we as parents are familiar with. Some of those books are outdated in certain ways. And also, there's so many good new books. The books that are coming out now, there's a difference with them because the competition is greater. So, like, the novels, for example, really grab you from the get-go, especially novels, YA novels for teenagers. If you don't grab that teenager in the first couple of pages, like, they're going back to Snapchat. So you have to hook them in, and they work really well. And then also, you know, the illustration is much more sophisticated. The characters are more diverse. The situations are more varied. They're more contemporary. So it's really good to keep on top of what's coming out. Sometimes what I would say, first of all, lean on local booksellers, local librarians, ask them for recommendations. Obviously, we have lots and lots of lists and recommendations in the book that are a good start. But I would say, don't assume necessarily that you know your kid. Sometimes, like, I remember with one of my kids, I thought, my child loves animals. He's going to love animal stories. Well, he doesn't love animal stories. A lot of animal stories are really sad. They often involve an animal dying, and he doesn't like sad books. And I love sad books. I love crying when I'm reading. It took me a while to realize, like, this kid just does not want any book that is sad. He likes funny books. So you need to kind of expose your child to a really wide range. And all kids don't necessarily like novels. Some kids like fact books. Some kids like comic books, or they like, you know, photo books, like 101 facts about, you know, horses, or, you know, sports statistics. So you really want to be open-minded and expose your kid to as wide a range as possible.
Say you feel like you've tried everything to get your kids to read, but they're just reluctant or they seem downright uninterested. Are there creative things to try with those kinds of kids?
Yeah, there are a lot of things you can do. And I think that if you're trying that hard, your kid probably knows you're trying that hard. So part of it is like, you know, it's on the parent. You might think that you're not putting pressure on them, but maybe you are, you know, not intentionally, but you kind of have to examine, like, what are the messages that I'm sending to my kid? Am I saying to my kid, like, hey, if you finish that book, you get iPad time, so that I'm turning reading into, like, something kind of obligatory that they have to do in order to get to the fun thing? Mm. What messages am I giving them? One of the tricks that we did with our kids, and this is just part of how you kind of build intrinsic motivation so that they're reading because they want to, as opposed to because someone else wants them to, or because they're going to get like a gold star at the end or get some kind of privilege or dessert or whatever it might be, is turn reading into a privilege. Like, reading is special. Sometimes I say to my kids, like, no, you can't read right now. I'm sorry, but we're at the table and this is, we're having conversation. Put the book away. So that sounds counterintuitive. My kids are a little older, but then it's like, okay, it does turn reading into something that's like kind of fun, kind of grown up, like something that like you don't always get to do. So I'm going to take advantage of the time when I do get to do that. You know, parents do all kinds of like somewhat, you know, maybe manipulative things, but you use a little psychology. One thing we did in our house was we had bedtime for our kids. So let's say bedtime was at 7. We would say, okay, bedtime is at 7, lights out. But look, if you want to read in bed, that's fine. You can stay up until 7:30. So what it does is it turns reading into a privilege. That's something that, like, you get to do. Older kids do. Grown-ups get to do it. And that worked. And, you know, now what I hear from my kids is, I just want to finish this chapter. Please let me get to the end of this page before I turn out the lights. Like, so it you know, a little bit of counter psychology can be effective.
Say you're the parents of a preteen or a teenager and they're reading a lot of graphic novels, maybe manga or even audiobooks, not your traditional words on the page kind of experience. Are the benefits the same, though?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Those are books. I read graphic novels. I love graphic novels. I think they're fantastic and they're great for kids. Not all kids want to read the same kind of book. Like, not every kid is going to grow up and like read the Lord of the Rings trilogy or become like a Jane Austen fan. Maybe they will. Maybe they will read both. I read, when I was growing up, Smurf comics, and I read Archie's, always Betty and Veronica, never Jughead. I read all those things. It didn't prevent me from growing up and, like, you know, reading Colson Whitehead and Edith Wharton and Toni Morrison. Like, you can enjoy both, but it's really important not to judge your kid by what he chooses to read. Be happy that he's reading. So look, if he's reading, you know, Minecraft fan fiction, great. That's what he's interested in. Let him follow those interests. He's choosing to pursue that interest in a book. And most kids are like most grown-ups. We don't always want to, like, have our spinachy books. You know, sometimes we want to challenge ourselves. And sometimes we're like, you know what? Like, I just want to read a thriller. I just want to read a romance. I want to just read something where I can kind of turn off my brain and have fun. Kids are like that, too. So they have to read those books, the good books, the spinach books sometimes for school. Let them read what they want at home. Because, again, if your child is choosing to read, then that will ultimately help them academically, because the more your kid is reading in his leisure time, the better he will be equipped to do that reading at school.
The book is How to Raise a Reader, and I certainly hope to do that. Co-author Pamela Paul, editor of the New York Times Book Review, thanks for the tips and thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And remember, you can catch up on past shows this holiday weekend by subscribing to our podcast. Just search for All In wherever you get podcasts and tap our blue and black logo. Tomorrow, we'll revisit a show we did on recycling in Indiana, specifically the capital city where we do our show. Turns out Indy doesn't have the best history with recycling, but our guests have some insight as to how that might change. So you'll hear that next time. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.